talk about subjects and objects, and I want to do it in, what I want to do is engage in a little bit of aspect changing, perspective changing, on and changing an aspect on things or changing perspectives can have totally trivial consequences, as in, well, back to Wittgenstein, my famous little fitters. He's got the duck rabbit. You all know the ambiguous figure of the duck rabbit. You look at it one way, you see it a rabbit. If you look at it another way, you see the duck. Well, that's an aspect change. But it's the consequences that are kind of trivial, unless you know, you're being pursued by one or the other creature. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, but there are perspective changes or aspect changes that have big, big consequences. And I would like to talk about two cases where, one case that's had an enormous effect on the course of my life, and that was an aspect change on what it is to be a subject. And the second half of my talk is about my work in neuroscience, where I learned about, I studied the research, and I started to come up, I started to realize that objects and subjects weren't the kinds of things that I actually thought they were, or experienced them to be. And I feel like the second half of my talk is probably something that I can talk, can contribute that other people couldn't contribute, so I thought that might be interesting to people because it's something that I've done and nobody else has done, and it's not that I'm special, it just happened that way. So the first part of my talk... I'll have two. So the first part of my talk is... So the perspective changes I want to do, as I said, are about objects and subjects. And the way I change them, I don't plan on convincing anybody of by either of them, but I kind of want you to, I want them to, like I said this morning about Wittgenstein, I just want them to cast a different light on something so that maybe you might think about them in a different way the next time you guys are all looking at objects, that you'll think about objects and yourself as a subject in a little bit different way. I mean, it'll just like, maybe it's just in the back of your mind, but it kind of, it's just a way to gel the whole situation in a different way. So I'm doing the basic structure of experience. As Angus said, I was trained as a phenomenologist. And phenomenology talks about the basic structure of all of our ordinary experiences. And those are structured into two poles, a subject pole and an object pole. So I, the perceiver, perceive, I think about, I wish for, I desire some object, some state of affairs, some thing, right? So the experience itself is kind of polarized into two pieces. And the subject and the object in ordinary experiences, specifically in perceptual experience, which I'm very interested in, those two things appear, the object and the subject, appear as separate and distinct. And we have this sense that they each have their features and they each have their distinctive characteristics and they have them in, from inside themselves rather than anywhere else. So a subject has subjective qualities and an object has its objective qualities, and you know you get to be an objective observer if you stick with its qualities because then you're not dangerously subjective. And so this is the basic structure of ordinary experience. This is how our world comes to us. This is how we see things, ourselves and our world. And we simply accept that independent status of subject and object. So the first half of the talk, I want to talk about the subject half, the subject with its features. And I want to consider the question, which we also heard about this morning, so maybe I can rush through this a little bit, but what makes somebody a philosopher, which Brad also, but I actually have a kind of different answer to that. So I don't think it's incompatible, but I think I have a different answer. And I want to do it in terms of a story because it's after lunch and I figure you guys are all going to be falling asleep, right? So I try to find stories. So the story is called The Interview. And this is a story of my first philosophy interview. Interview is an almost to be, I was almost going to get my degree, right? A couple months later, I got my degree. So I went to this prestigious private Northern California university and I was interviewed by the illustrious faculty. And Of course, as these things go, they always ask you about your document. You guys all know this. They ask you about your thesis, and they make you, you know, they ask you pointed questions that you're supposed to answer and be able to cogently argue for and so on. Then there's the second part of the interview where the illustrious faculty members present their illustrious views, right, their theories and their books, and you're supposed to know all about those too. And you're supposed to be a little stupid because they're going to be showing off and telling you how good they are. But, you know, you're supposed to be able to banter in your field with them. And then there's this part called your research, right? So you're going to be a philosophy professor, and they want to know what is this going to be, you know? And then I knew I was in big trouble. Right? I could do the first two parts, but the second part, I knew I was in trouble as soon as we started. This is 1981, and my main interest was the relation of certain kinds of research in neuroscience and questions in perception and the mind-body problem. I'm terribly influenced by Merleau-Ponty. I taught Merleau-Ponty in Paris at the École Polytechnique to French people because I didn't think they understood him. And so Merleau-Ponty wrote his thesis and a very important book on neuroscience and philosophical questions, Structure of Behavior, it's called. And I was very influenced by that as a young person, and that was in 1972. And so now we're like almost a decade later, and I'm like, okay, now it's my turn. I get to do what I want, and this is what I'm going to do. So I told them that. And there's just dead silence in the room. In 1989, it was accepted fact that neuroscience had absolutely nothing to do with anything in philosophy. A neuroscientist couldn't address any issue in philosophy, that those were totally separate things and irrelevant. You know, fields, they were totally separate and they didn't have anything to do with each other. And I looked at them and I said, how can you hope to solve the mind-body problem if you don't know anything about a body? I said, you know, I haven't seen any minds walking around without bodies or bodies without minds. And if they're dead, they're not a body, they're a corpse, right? So these things seem you can't pull them apart. They're just together all the time, you know. And I said, and besides that, you know, your big hot topic right now is, can machines think, right? This is back in 1981. I said, how can you answer that question if you don't have any idea what real bodies are doing? I mean, and you're saying, well, the hardware's the same thing, you know. Well, how do you know? You don't know anything about what the body's doing. And you haven't even asked the question. And it seemed to me, I said, these questions are really important. So I said, there's some questions that really... And so they said, okay, what's your theory? And I said, I haven't got a theory, and quite frankly, I don't even know what a theory would look like at this point. But there are important questions that need to be asked on both sides. I didn't get the job. And after the interview, it was reported that, one, I had too many questions, and two, I wasn't knowledgeable. Now, I considered them to be profoundly unphilosophical. And I want to tell you that this interview, whatever else it shows a collision between two different definitions of what it is to be a philosopher. Definitely, at least from my side, that's how I viewed it. My interviewers were looking for a person that had certain qualities, that possessed certain knowledge, that owned a theory, that had ideas, had written them down in a book, and this is all stuff that Brad was talking today. You know, philosophy isn't the production of an object and so on. And this is what made a person a philosopher. It was facts about that person. For even your ideas that get in a book are called by us intellectual property. That means they're ours. They're properties of us, our intellect, right? We own them, and we just put them on a piece of paper. And that's, you know, so they're really facts about us. So you get to be famous because your ideas got in a book that everybody talks about or so on, whatever. So, however, this isn't the only view of what makes somebody a philosopher. And Brad's talk today can show that for certain. And it wasn't the only view that, it certainly wasn't the view that I shared. And I have to say that I became a philosopher because at the age of 13, I saw an enactment of Plato's Apology on television, and on black and white television. I remember exactly where I was. And it was the death of Socrates, and I watched it, and I got done, and I turned it on, and I said to myself, that's who I am. That's what I'm going to be. And it was Socrates who was my model. And throughout antiquity, for hundreds, for centuries, we're talking centuries, for a good part of philosophical history, it was Socrates who was considered the model of the ideal philosopher. And although we don't have any first-hand information, we only have second-hand information about him, it's very interesting that we do know some things, and what we know is very interesting in the light of my interview. For one, Socrates was never educated as a philosopher. That we know for sure. There was no philosophical education in those days. And the only thing that was sophism, or the sophists, who were people who taught people how to talk, basically, rhetoric, and how to argue in a political setting and so on. Not that I'm saying that's not philosophical, but I'm just saying there was no formal philosophy in those days. Second of all, he never founded a school. Third, he never taught philosophy. Fourth, he never formulated any theory. Fifth, he never wrote any book, a dialogue, anything. And fifth, as Brad said today, he's famous for his claim to have known nothing. Now I ask you, what is it about this person? What did he possess? There's nothing about him. If he would have been in that interview, they would have booted him. He wouldn't have fit the convention. He didn't possess the stuff, right? So what was it about this guy who walked around Athens questioning his fellow citizens that made him a philosopher? And for this, I think I want to tell you another story, and this one was told by Plato himself. One of Socrates' friends once asked the Delphic oracle, that is, Apollo, whether there was anyone wiser than Socrates. And the Delphic oracle, I don't know if he or she thought about it for very long, but said, no, there's no one. And then this, the word got back to Socrates, right? And he was dumbfounded that he was said to be the wisest person. So what did he do? As is his wont, he went out in the streets of Athens and he started asking people that should be, were known to be wise people in the convention of his society at the time, questions. And what did he find out? He found out that although those people thought they knew everything about the thing that he asked them about, in fact, they didn't. They didn't know. And the only conclusion he could draw from that was that he was thought to be wise because at least he knew that he didn't know. And Plato gives us this as the definition of a philosopher. But I don't think if we asked Socrates, he would have given us a definition at all. And I don't think this is would be what he would cite as his philosophical credentials. I think it's something else that defines Socrates as a philosopher, and the something else that it is the way he lived. It's what he did. And in this respect, I feel he's been my role model in a way. And what he did was ask questions. He asked fundamental questions. And the point wasn't so much to get an answer as it was to reveal assumptions and inherent contradictions in one's way of thinking that canceled out wrong views more than it was to create a right view. So the point wasn't so much to get at a definition of what virtue was as to show you that your idea about virtue ran into problems. If I push you on the consequences of that view, I can show you that what you assumed isn't right. Now there's a whole school of Tibetan Buddhism actually that works on just pointing out consequences in people, a whole philosophical approach in Buddhism that just works with consequences. Never says, therefore, this. It just says, this and then that? Oh, no. This and that? No. It just points out consequences. So this idea of pointing out, getting a question under the skin so that you can see that it just does, something doesn't work, that you've made a false assumption, that you have carried something in that you didn't even know you carried in, this is what I think constituted his philosophical credentials. And another reason I think that throughout antiquity this remained the essential definition of a philosopher, this way of life of asking questions, is that for generations and generations after Socrates, and even right after him in the 3rd century BC, people who were considered philosophers or considered themselves philosophers held many different kinds of theories, many, many kinds of theories. There were Cynics and Stoics and Epicureans and Platonists and Aristotelians, and, you know, there's just all kinds of theories that go with that, but they all considered themselves philosophers. And I think if it had been up to a particular theory or a particular point of view or a particular certain kind of style or answer to questions, you would see if they all claimed to be that thing, then they would have been more uniformity than we see. And yet they all considered themselves philosophers, because why? They all engaged in rational discourse, questioning things. They all questioned. And then they lived a life in accordance with their questioning. They lived a kind of life. And in fact, they lived almost like schools of philosophy in those days were almost like monasteries are in Tibetan Buddhism, because they lived together, they ate together, they shared a certain kind of style and value, but they might in that place all have different answers to that thing. So I want to suggest that it's the form of life, in fact, that defines me, at least in the way of understanding, not my interviewers, but in my way of understanding things. It's the fact that I ask these questions. And I've done it in many fields, not only as a philosopher, you know, but I did it, my next incarnation was in cognitive science, and I did it, I lived cognitive science philosophically. My next was, I worked in neuroscience, I did neuroscience philosophically. I asked fundamental questions about what was going on. And I'm now a religious person, and I live my religion philosophically. I don't live it as a mere belief system or whatever. I use this as a way to further my questioning. I'm engaged in fundamental questioning on a series of questions I've been asking ever since I was 13 years old about minds and bodies and what it is to be a mind and a body. So both the philosopher and ultimately the characteristic of being wise, what is it that defines a philosopher? We're called philosophers, right? Philosophia, or as in where I got my PhD is Weisbegierde. I'm enthusiastic for wisdom, right? The goal of philosophy in the ancient world is definitely wisdom, to achieve wisdom. Maybe not truth, but wisdom. And what was that wisdom? If we look at Socrates again, it's embodied in Socrates' behavior, and that was that he always had a peaceful mind. He could be in the middle of a war. He could be freezing to death. He was perfectly happy. He could be at a banquet. He could be drunk as a skunk, and he was perfectly happy. He was remarkably happy at all times. And in fact, this peace of mind became the definition of wisdom in the ancient world. And it was this, but why, where did they get that from? He got that from asking fundamental questions. It was the absence of perplexity in his mind, confusion, artificial assumptions about things. He went to his death with a calm mind. Why? Because he could look at the reasons for running away from Athens to escape it and look at the reasons for staying and make a rational decision about it and be totally calm about that, because he was sure. He had a surety, a calmness that's elimination of obscuration. So this idea of a person and their qualities being defined by a way of living challenges this kind of solipsistic view we have of ourselves as these little kind of things with our properties and so on, and we carry them around with us, and somebody buys and sells them, and we put them in a book and so on. Because that allows somebody like me to consider themselves to be fundamentally a philosopher, although I've never done anything Brad has done. I've never written a book in philosophy, never published anything in philosophy. But I consider myself to be a philosopher, and my life to be a philosophical life. And I'm only a philosopher as long as I do the activity of questioning. And as soon as I cease to do that, I cease to be a philosopher. That's how I feel. So that's how I view the subject in philosophy, and I as a philosopher. But I also want to say that it's very interesting that a subject can become an object as well. You know, we've been talking about this stuff, you know, today. When a philosopher is observed by others, when we look at Socrates and his look at his life, the way he lives it, and objectify it, the effect that that way of life can have on others, once it's made into an object. A way of life isn't either even really even a subject or an object. It's an event, right? It's something going on that gives rise to these things. But if we make it into, if we shove it over to the object pole, it has an effect on others when profoundly lived that's similar to a work of art's effect on people, I think. And I just want to mention two things before I go on to my topic of objects. And that is that Socrates is, I'm back, I'm going to stick with Socrates because he's my dream date, sort of, you know. Socrates, I guess, just two things about him. One is that he exerted an enormous attraction on people that he, who saw him, who watched him walk around Athens. So much so that it's described as erotic. People were erotically attracted to him. And they're watching him, his way of being, led them to adopt his method of self-examination and self-questioning in their own lives. They became little philosophers because they started asking questions, too, of themselves at his prompting. This changed them, and thus they came to view themselves and their whole world in completely different ways. And in a way, my experience of artworks, I'm not a professional person with artworks. I wrote my MA thesis in aesthetics, but I don't deal with works of art in per se, but I've got to say that when I've interacted with great works of art or something that really, it's done that kind of thing to me. It's completely changed my life, how I live, how I view myself and my world. By just observing it, reading it, listening to it, I'm a big music person, and so I, like, if I listen to Brahms' symphony, you know, I'm just torn up. Every auditory experience after that is never going to be the same. People's voices are going to be mixed in, everything in it. So it completely transforms us in our world. Also, Socrates is well known for being a very disturbing thing in his society. He was described as atopos. We could say that's atypical, but I think I'm going to use Victoria's word of uncanny, strange. His way of life shook the foundations of the lives of those people he met. His way of being called their way of being into question. Alcibiades, one of his main disciples and somebody who was very erotically attracted to Socrates, once said that meeting Socrates and having to answer his questions had driven him to the brink of suicide. Here again, I think we find a parallel with great works of art because they can shake us up in that way. And not only that, they can shake us up to such an extent that we can want to get rid of them. People have burned them, right? What did they do to Socrates? It wasn't because it was because he was atopos. It was because he was so atypical that they got rid of him. Not because he propounded any particular idea, but his very way of being was just unsettling to be around. He's bad for the kids, right? Get him out, right? So anyway, that's my bridge into real objects instead of subject objects. Now, I've adopted a philosophical method that's really a lot like Socrates in the sense that my approach to philosophy is a lot like house cleaning rather than house building. Like theory building, I have trouble, I don't do, but I do, I like to look at the foundations. I like to clean the closets. That's what I like to do. And, bye. his method of doing philosophy reminds me, as we were talking about Wittgenstein today, a lot of Wittgenstein's idea, and this whole idea that philosophy, the point of philosophy is showing the fly the way out of the fly bottle, right? It's this fly that's, I don't know if you got the analogy, it's this fly that's like going crazy, right? And you just say, that way out, and it goes out, and it's like, oh, thank goodness. It just undoes the problem, right? right? The door is there if you just go out the door, right? Oh, I see, I see. The problem was I was banging against the theories and things. So in both cases, Socrates and Wittgenstein, we get the feeling that the problem with a theory or theory building sometimes is that the theories will paper right over assumptions that are wrong. And then you'll end up with a whole new set of problems that are caused by a set of assumptions that were wrong in the first place, but you just built something over them and dusted it off and said, and now we'll just argue about these problems up here because we're philosophical or we're whatever, and now we're just going to argue about mind-body problems. I'm a materialist. I'm an idealist. I'm a materialist. I'm an idealist. And we're just going to hit up against each other forever. So using this method, in 1982, as I told you, I wasn't, it wasn't that I didn't get offered a job in philosophy, but after that interview and another one, I realized that I really didn't want to be somebody who knew everything because I had too many questions. So I was offered a position as a postdoctoral fellow at Berkeley in the new cognitive science program there. The same year I joined a lab in neuroscience, Walter Freeman's lab at Berkeley. I was studying perception, which was exactly what I was interested in, following Merleau-Ponty and others. And it's not surprising that since neuroscientists are people first and neuroscientists second, that they make the same sets of assumptions and have the same experiences of the world that we all do. So, of course, they start by assuming that objects that are perceived enjoy a kind of independence, an independent existence from perceivers. They're over there, I'm here. That's how I experience it. That's how I see it. That's how I hear it. That's how I, when I touch something, that's what taste is like. And so, given this, the problem for them, the perceptual problem for them as neuroscientists and brain theorists is to explain how information about that thing out in the world, that painting, that object, gets internalized inside of me as a perceiver so that I can know about it. We're independent, so I gotta get something in because it's out there, right? So that's the basic problematic. No questions asked until I came. And then questions got asked. But when I got there in the 80s, beginning of the 80s, perceptual system research had been going on since the early 50s. And there was a body of data that had been collected that everybody agreed on. And everybody had divided up into two levels of functioning and so on. It was very straightforward. And it was data that was gathered from the outside in, right? We're trying to get the, and you follow like Hansel and Gretel's breadcrumbs into the brain, right? It's like a little string and you're following it. So you're going to go, because you can't go the other way around. There's 10 million zillion of those guys in the brain, right? So you got to go from the outside in. Okay, so they started on the outside. So they started in the eye, and they did, in fact, start with vision. And that was Hubel and Wiesel, and they were in Canada. And they studied these neurons in the eyes. And they found something really cool, they thought, you know. These little neurons each act all by themselves. And they're very, as they called them, narrowly tuned. They're very highly selective. Red light, not green. Line, vertical line, not horizontal line. Line or no line. Light or dark. They're very, very specific. Each one seems to be only able to interact with a very specific and tiny bit of information, right? So this is what they found at this level. They call these guys receptors. You already understand why they call them receptors? This is the model, right? Information has to get in from the outside independent object. Something's got to get received. That information's got, so these are receptor neurons. Now, I mean, these descriptions, they don't even notice. I mean, they don't really notice this in the field. They just get the name, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, it fits them. So the next level was, because they didn't have any, they weren't too clever, it was the post-receptor level. They ran out of ideas after receptor. Neuroscientists aren't big on ideas. They're big on data and machines and things. So the next level, these receptor neurons would feed into the farther in, and the next level are these post-receptors. Post-receptors are triggered by the activity of those receptors. But the POS receptors don't work all by themselves. They work in these little networks, these little local networks. And a network is responsible for the same part of a visual field. So for example, that network might have a neuron that's connected to a receptor neuron that's sensitive to the color red, and another one that's sensitive to the color green. This would be in the human visual system. So if it gets input from that red receptor neuron, what happens is because it's connected with this other one, it inhibits the activity of the other one and in effect says, it's not green, it's red there, basically, because it's contrasting, right? Or instead of having inhibitory interreaction with the other neuron, it might have excitatory, which means basically it's saying and instead of or, this and that. So line segment, line segment and this line segment or whatever it's putting. So it's association and it's contrast. Post receptors. You got it down. Now you know half of what's going on in the brain. Next thing is at the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, they found two new kinds of neural activity. One they called super network activity, and this was in the cortex. So now we're talking about really in the workhorse part of the brain, right? We're not talking about stuff that's feeding in anymore. Now it's where it's happening, kids. This is it, you know. You're sexy as a neuroscientist if you work on this part, right? they found these super networks, and they hadn't found them before because they didn't have the technology, but what happened was that these neurons are distributed all over, but they work as a network, and the reason they found out that they worked as a network, they worked together, and they were doing more of this association and contrast, was that they were able to record in such a way that they found out that when these things were associated, when they were associating, putting together, or contrasting something, their activity became synchronized. So instead of going pop, 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 they went pop, 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 and that for the brain signaled these things belong together in some way, right? So this is like a big network instead of a teeny weeny little network, and it's distributed in the cortex. And the other thing that was found, and this was the lab that I was working in the late 70s, Walter Freeman discovered mass neural mass activity, which was global activity. An entire subsystem of the brain would become active as a whole. And they couldn't discover this until they had nonlinear dynamical systems theory and modeling. And the reason I ended up in his lab was that my friends were at Santa Cruz and UC down here at LA. And they had been doing this modeling, this mathematics, and they told me I should go to his lab because he was using that mathematics, and he was using it because you can't really discover this global activity until you have the right kind of mathematical system to analyze that kind of data. He's getting data from huge arrays of electrodes instead of like one here and one there and one there. So it required a whole new technology. So anyway, he discovered this neural mass activity. So now you've got the whole story. You guys know everything that happens in a perceptual system because basically to this date, that's all there is. That's it. There's a lot of stuff about it, but you don't need to know that because I'm not going to talk about it. So the really important part is how did they interpret this data? I'm a philosopher. neural activity for them since the 50s was understood as an information processing system. Takes information in, and then it manipulates that information and produces what, a correlate or some kind of analog. So they had a representational theory of neural processing or neural activity. Neurons were busy creating representations inside the brain of the external object. And they interpreted the activity that they found in the following way. The selective response activity of those receptors in the eye, for example, that got to specific things, right? They'd only interact with specific aspects. They'd only engage in certain kinds of interaction. That got read as feature detection and feature representation. So now these little things are called feature detectors. In the same paper, they went from just plain neuron to receptor neuron to feature detector. The same paper by Barlow, who formulated the neuron doctrine. Now, that just, I mean, well, I'll leave it at that. Post receptors, at the next level, those little tiny networks with the either or and and, right? That got interpreted as the first level of feature integration. So this is the first level at which some of these little bits and pieces get put together or eliminated, right? And the rest of all this activity, super network and neural mass action, was assigned the task of compiling all of that stuff into one internal correlate of the percept, what was seen, an object, a process, or whatever. Now, this is, okay, I now arrive on the scene in my lab. You know, I don't know how I ever got hired. It's just like, I remember I walked into the lab with Walter. Here was this guy, two different color socks, feet on the desk, smoking a cigar. This is in the school. You can tell this is a while back. Smoking a cigar with a cage built into the wall right next to his feet with an iguana hissing at me, right? This is like, and he said, what do you want? And I said, I want to know how the brain works. And he says, I do too. Sit down. That is my interview. I passed. So anyway, when I joined forces there, the first thing I asked for was what was it that, how did they know these things were representing? How did they know neural activity was representing? Like, what told you? And then he told me all about machines. And I said, no. I said, we build machines, and we read the final thing, and we say they represent something. But I'm saying, how does this brain know that, is this working as a representation for the brain? There was absolutely no evidence for this at all. And I said, you know, you don't have any evidence. And that was my response. Second of all, I think I was in the second seminar that we had every week with the graduate students. I pointed out that representational theories of perception have an enormously long history of failure. They just don't work. And I had studied in 72 Merleau-Ponty's critique of representational thinking and so on, and I just knew this wasn't going to work. This was not going to work. There are just myriads of, there's just a myriad problems that you run up to, right? And one of them, of course, being the one that I was raising in the beginning. How do you know this is, how would it know it's a representation of something, right? If you need a representation to bridge a gap between an object and a perceiver, then when it gets the correlate inside of it, it's got to know it's a correlate. It's got to know, like, he's got to know it's a painting about something, right, or a representation about something. Therefore, it has to become an object for that system. But if you need something to bridge the gap between the system and the object, you need another representation. You end up with this infinite regress of representations. Infinite regress means no goal. Just doesn't go. It's a conceptual flaw, right? So I pointed that out. More dead silence. But Walter was getting shaken profoundly. And so we looked at his data, and I pointed out that his data didn't fit any of the qualifications for a representation at all. And I won't go into that here, but, you know, it just didn't have that one-to-one correspondence that it needed. You know, it didn't have any of the stuff. You'd get this different pattern every time. The poor animal would smell something, you know, be a little bit different, was kind of the same, like I'm the same as my sister, sort of, you know, we belong to the same family. That's like, yeah, right. And then if I taught you something else in between, the whole thing changed, everything changed, well then how did that pattern, now how did it know it was that same odor if the whole thing had changed? And after all, it's a system that only has access to what's in it, right? So how would it know? Anyway, but what was really telling to me was that after working for 8 years in this laboratory, I noticed something very interesting. The binding process, this whole idea of gathering all these things in features into a complete internal representation, was coming to be called the binding problem. You know, I mean, so we're playing taps here, right? And my colleagues were argued till the cows came home. The only problem was they didn't have enough data. 1990. Last year I was invited to a conference. And guess what? 2007. They still haven't found it. And they're still looking. They hadn't found it then. 20 years later they haven't found it. And so I'm saying, I think we need to take a radical new look at this whole situation. I bought all of these things. I was never clear about the subject-object separation. I took it for granted, too. But by 1990, I was sick of playing the game, and I just decided, I think a whole new way of looking at this has to be. Maybe the way we experience things perceptually isn't the way things are. That occurred to me suddenly, right? Maybe how we see things, that's the product of perception, not the cause of the perceptual activity. So I started to develop, and it took me 3 years. This is my first 3 years of retreat under the guidance of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. This is what I'm doing for recreational activity. I developed a non-representational model of perception, or a way of asking questions that allowed me to refocus the data in a different way. So, and I started with a totally different assumption. And instead of thinking about the separation, object and perceiver, externality of the two, I decided to view the two as no gap, no break, no independence. Reject the whole idea that was where I was going to start. Get rid of the independence. Now, if I thought about that, and I thought, you know, this kind of fits science better than it fits than this other view. Because in science, we talk about causation all the time. We're talking about things that are interrelated causally, right? We're not talking about things that are separate. If things are inherently separate, if by nature to be an object is to be independent, you could never know about it because you couldn't get into any relation with it. It's an independent thing by nature. Very Buddhist argument, that. But that's one problem. And I thought about, for example, like the objects in my yard where I was doing my retreat, and I thought, you know, that tree, what, it doesn't know about any breaks between it and the tree over there. There, I mean, it's just a bunch of, it's like a soup of physicality. There's just photons, elements, stuff, waves, part of everything flying all over there. I mean, like, there's any the breaks? I don't know. So anyway, I thought, oh yeah, it sounds real crazy, and it, everything I experience dictates against it, but I'm going to assume it anyway and see what happens. So that's what I did. however, it's undeniable that we experience things the opposite way. For me, however, this becomes a question to be, a problem to be answered, to solve it, not a thing to take for granted. Why is it that if things weren't that way to start out with, that's how we experience things? How does that happen? And I could, the only thing I could hypothesize was that somehow perception was doing it, was involved in this. So I went back and looked at the data, and I started all over. I started in the sense organ. And I just hope this isn't boring all of you, but it's just like, this was so amazing to me. You know, it was just like, whoa, it took me a really long time because I just felt like I was thinking through mud. I mean, I was just thinking against everything that I took for granted, everything I'd ever learned about perception, everything Roland Ponty wrote or anybody who I thought was radical. It just, you know, I just had to keep forcing myself every day to show up and do this. So first of all, I looked at the sense organs, and not at the neurons first, the sense organs. I just looked at the sense organs. Now, neuroscientists, as is their wont, neuroscientists, they're busy with the neurons, you know. They just happen to be stuck in an eye and an ear and a nose and things like that. Not that they totally disregard them, but they have like a paragraph this much and then a book this thick, right? The first paragraph is about the sense organ, and then you got a text that's 4 inches thick about what neurons do, right? Because the main emphasis is on information processing, right? So anyway, I looked at the sense organs, and I found out, you know, when I looked at them with fresh eyes, they actually do some very interesting things. Each sense organ has evolved to interact with only a specific class, a kind of physical event. Eyes, lenses of eyes interact with light waves, ears with sound waves, tongues with certain kinds of chemicals, noses with certain kinds of chemical events, and so on. This means that, in effect, if you start with an unbroken soup, if you start with an unbroken web of physicality, what they have, in effect, done right there is to extract or pull out a subclass of physical events. They've taken this web of things and pulled out of that web just certain things that they're going to interact with. And that's what an eye is, and that's what an ear is. Not only that, the second thing they do is they totally transform the character of those events. So light waves now become colors. It's like putting it through a prism, right? You put in white light through the prism, you get out these yellows and greens and whatever, right? You get color. What do we perceive? Colored surfaces. Do we perceive light waves, rays? No, we don't. Waves, particles, we don't. We see colored surfaces. We see things defined in terms of colors, right? So they do that, and not only that, they do something else really interesting, and that is that each one of those, with the series of events that impinge on it, creates a kind of holistic entity there. In the lens of the eye, as outside observers, we see it producing an image on the back of the eyeball, right? We see it producing a complex color, kind of really holistic thing that's color, a color event, a phenomenal event of color, right? So I thought, here's a holistic event. Here's the holism. It isn't the end product, it's where it started. I may be wrong, but they haven't got a candidate to offer to plant mine. So I'm still waiting. So if they come up with one, that's fine, but they haven't. So I suggested that the holism is in the beginning, that everything is very holistic to start with, and the whole binding problem just went away. Because you don't have to put together all the pieces, because they're all together to start out with. So we don't have to construct holism. So now we have to have a whole new reading of what neurons were doing, because after all, before they were just putting pieces together. That's all they were doing. So now what could they be thought to be doing? So I had to go back and look at the data again. And I looked at receptor. Now I did receptor neurons. And I looked at them, and what did they do? What was happening when they, what were they? Now, I'm thinking of neurons here, and I think, well, you know, they're interacting with this holistic, this thing that's happening at the back of the eye, right, in the visual system, but highly selectively. So in effect, what they do is they shatter that whole into all of these tiny little pieces. And the stimuli become the discrete stimuli they are, because they're interacted with discreetly. Each of those neurons acts all by itself. Its use is discrete. Hence, the stimuli become discrete, and the holistic thing ends up being shattered. Now we have pieces. Before, we had no pieces, because it hasn't been used as pieces. It needed to be used as pieces first. So the discrete nature of the stimuli are inherited from the form of use made by the system, that it's discrete. And then not only that, complexity is imposed on this holistic event by virtue of the fact that we've broken it up into all these pieces. So it's because the variety of finely tuned interaction use made of that holistic event, it becomes a complex event for the organism. I mean, for me, looking outside at what an eye is doing, you know, in visual research, yeah, you see the image on the back of the, oh, look, it's got all these pieces and features. It hasn't been used that way yet by the organism. The organism doesn't know pieces yet, right? It doesn't have to know pieces. It actually makes pieces. So this was the second thing. Now, this means that the whole idea of representation just is going to fall by, because we don't have representations here. Copying things. We have creative processes. Things become discrete because I use them discreetly. Things gain their quality of complexity because I use it in a complex way. We don't read it off the stimulus, we impose it on it instead. So now we get to post-receptor neurons and all of these little networks and their contrast use and so on. And my hypothesis is that this level creates the qualitative character of the things, the features, these aspects of the stimulus. And it does so in the following way. And I said in the human visual system, red and green light are contrast. They feed into this little network, and they're brought into relationship with one another. So you can't have green and red at the same time. And they get their qualitative character from the fact that they're being contrast with that kind. That contrast is undergone. In a bird, those light forms are contrast with other forms of light that we can't even see. So they get contrast with ultraviolet and infrared light. There's no way that a bird's, that same wavelength that we call red light, is experiences red, the way we experience red, because it's brought into a whole set of conditions of relationships and contrast that ours isn't. And I hypothesize that, I know a lot of features I can mention that actually are like this, right, that in the system itself that I can watch the contrast and so on. And it's clear that a quality for the organism is being created by these contrasts and these relationships that they're brought into. So basically, qualities result from use. Pieces result from use. Holism of the percept results from use. However, we still have a last level. We still have this this mass action level. Because I'm going to put all the neural network, big and little neural networks, into the second level of feature work. Because they're all using the same mechanism. So it seems to me they're all doing the same thing. Whether they do it on a... They might do it involving more bits and more pieces or whatever, but they're doing the same thing. What remains to be explained is what no perceptual theorist ever in neuroscience ever addressed, and it's how do we get to have an object and a subject, right? Have I ever seen that in any neuroscience book? Never. Never. And you won't today, and you didn't see it when I was working on this in the 70s, or 80s, or 90s, or 2000s. So I'm left with neural mass action, and this is something I really knew about because I was really working on it. And this neural mass action is really interesting because, as I said, you know, it generates a whole system. For example, the entire olfactory bulb, or the whole section of the visual cortex, all becomes active as a group. All is a one huge mass. To me, what this is it's creating a system, basically. So this massive activity is actually creating subsystems within the organism. So this mass action is actually articulating or pulling apart the organism itself, the perceiver, into subsystems of its own action. So in other words, it's creating a visual perceptual system and an olfactory visual perceptual system and so on. A motor system, and it's doing that by activity. It's an action. It's not an anatomical fact. Otherwise, a corpse would see something. You know, it's still got all the pieces, but it's not doing anything. It's because there's no real system there. It's activity that defines it as a system. So this allows the whole organism to articulate itself into aspects of use, different kinds of use. But the other thing that's very interesting about this global activity is that it only happens if there's massive feedback from the rest of the brain. So we found that in the olfactory bulb, Walter did, that if you cut the connections with the olfactory bulb and the rest of the brain and still fed the input in, it wouldn't generate mass action. It required this enormous amount of feedback from all these other parts of the brain. Why? Why? Now, this is purely speculative on my part, but I really think it needs to be examined. My feeling is that once you've articulated the whole system into wholes, it allows you, I mean, into parts, right? It allows you to use the results of the functioning of a part as something other than, or information about something other. And it allows you to contrast that with everything that's left as self. So you can then objectify the results of a visual system to tell you something about the way that your embeddedness in the world, how you're embedded in its relationship with all the other things that you're connected to. You can read back. You can, in other words, objectify part of what it is to be you, and the results of that functioning then can be pulled apart. So I thought, my hypothesis is, and I say I don't have, nobody's tested it, but this is my hypothesis. So the feedback allows contrast of part and whole, and in this case, the part could be an object. The result of the visual system functioning, that result can be read as an object. And now the it's contrasted with all the rest of me, my arms, my legs, my motor, my hearing, and so on, because it's all interconnected. So this brings me to the end of the talk. And so for me, from what I found out about the brain, and and from my reading of the data and from rethinking the thing and the failure of our ability to account for it any, the other way, the way we experience it, the continual failure over more than a century of trying to conceptually make the models work and experimentally find the things we needed to find, indicate that perception is actually a process not of information processing, internalizing data, but is a process in which we articulate our very embeddedness in the environment, that it's a form of life that generates both subject and object. But subject and object are the objectivity of things, the fact that they are things for us with certain features and objects are relative to the organism, not they are not facts about the world before. Take out the organisms and there are, for a tree, this building, there are no objects. Objects are what we perceive. They're relative to a mind body complex that does something very interesting in this world. This means that the whole idea of a gap can't be, it doesn't, isn't anything that would be copied from the world. It's actually produced. So there's no notion in which we're representing things anymore. So the whole representational theory is unnecessary according to this. So, in conclusion, I just want to say, I hope this has made you think a little bit differently about things you see next time you see them and about you as a seer. And say that forms of use, ways of living, because I view perception as a form of life, as a way of living, as a way of acting and behaving, engaging in activity, are keys for understanding both myself and my world. And that I am the result of forms of use in at least two ways that I pointed out today. One, it was a form of life that I consider philosophical that makes me a philosopher, and that I am a subject, experienced as a subject, independent from objects because of a form of life that I engage in that's called perception. So thank you very much, and I'm very honored to be here.